Well, good morning and welcome. As we kick off this series, we thought we'd do so in a little bit of a comical way and just kind of call our attention to something that we want to spend a little bit of time on for the next couple weeks. And obviously, as we come into this series and you look at that tagline, everything's amazing and nobody's happy. Obviously, everything is not amazing. And as we come into this conversation, I want to make sure that I say from the very beginning that this conversation is not about how everything's great and there's no pain. That's not the message of the scriptures. That's not God's message to us. That's not the message of this conversation, that everything is amazing. The truth is, we live in a world that's broken. You go back to our In the Meantime series, we talked about the brokenness of the world and the pain of the world. But there's a reason why that video is so funny. There's a reason why, and if you've ever seen the whole thing, it's hysterical. And there's a reason why we find it funny, because there's a truth behind it. There's something to it. There's something to our ability to be able to take the good things in our life and drain the life out of them. There's something to our ability to be able to, and it seems that we have an unparalleled ability to be able to drain the life out of the good things in our life. And obviously they're making jokes about flying, but we see this all the time in our life. So we used to love our iPhone, but then we found out that there's a phone that displays text messages on the side. And you're like, my phone doesn't display text messages on the side. And you used to love it. You were excited about it. But then we have the ability. It's crazy. We have the ability to drain the life out of things. And we're doing this all the time. This is a huge part of our story, a huge part of our life. It's funny. I just saw this the other day, and we all have experienced this. I remember when I first came into Hoboken, everybody wanted to live in a luxury building. And so you had these buildings that were being built, and everyone's advertising, it's a luxury building. If you live in a luxury building now, I mean, hey, who doesn't? Okay? But then the other day I saw an advertisement for an Uber luxury building. And this is like six steps up, because then, you know, there was luxury and we were really happy with luxury. Like, oh, I live in a luxury building. You'd say that with pride. But then all of a sudden there was ultra luxury. You're like, oh, that building's an ultra luxury. My refrigerator's still white. And you're thinking about whether you can buy a sticker to make it stainless steel or something. But like, how do I, and now there's Uber. I don't even know what Uber luxury is. I don't even know you could put those two words together, but they have. And we live in this crazy world. We live in this crazy, crazy world where we have an unparalleled ability to be able to drain the life out of things. And sometimes it's funny. Sometimes it's funny, like the phones and the buildings, and you look at what Louis C.K. is saying there about flying. Sometimes it's funny, but then other times it can be quite destructive. A couple months ago, I was talking with a couple and talking through their marriage situation. And we began to talk about their marriage, and they began to tell me their story. And they were just about at the end of their marriage. They were pretty set on the fact that they were going to get divorced. And they started to talk to me about their marriage. And as I listened, I was confused. I was confused, because as they told me their problems, there are problems that, to be honest, almost every married couple has. And I listened to their struggles, and I couldn't understand why they were so unhappy with their marriage. Because as they talked to them about their marriage, to be honest, it sounded like my marriage. It sounded like the struggles that Anna and I have and the things that we have to work through. And yet they found themselves at this point where they were ready to walk away. They were done with it. They were so angry with one another. And I was confused. To be honest, for several of our meetings, I sat there and just thought, what in the world is happening here? Am I missing something? Is there something that they're not being honest with me about? Is there something that they're not telling me? And so I kept asking more questions to be able to get to the bottom of it, of what's really happening here. Why are you so unhappy? Why are you so willing to walk away? And I was confused for quite a while, but then all of a sudden I started to hear it. in little things that they would say and in little statements that they would make about their situation or about their spouse, all of a sudden I began to hear it. These incredible expectations that they had created of what their life was supposed to look like, of what their spouse was supposed to look like, of how their marriage was supposed to work. And as I continued in the conversation with them, and once I started to hear it, I started to look for it more. And as I looked for it more, it was unbelievable the amount of expectations that these individuals had begun to develop of what their life was supposed to look like. I think as I interacted with it more and more, I came to the realization that they thought that their entire life was supposed to be like the first half of The Notebook. Every day. How many of you haven't seen The Notebook? I use it frequently in message illustrations, so you should watch it. It's important. So, but they had this idea that it's just going to be where we're just kissing in the rain and it's just amazing. And all these expectations of what their marriage was going to be and what their spouse was going to be and what their family was going to look like. And so even though they had to be honest, a good marriage, they were completely discontent with it. They were so frustrated with it. And I looked at them and said, you realize that these expectations that you've created, you're literally draining the life out of your marriage. That is a good marriage. And you have the problems that other people have, but you don't have to allow them to destroy you. But they had learned. They had learned what all of us learn. They had learned what all of us learn to some degree. And that is this. They learn how to be able to manufacture discontentment. They learn, and all of us have the ability to do this, and all of us, to be honest with you, are pretty good at this. They learn how to manufacture discontentment. And so rather than being content with what they had, they were constantly looking at what they didn't have. And in the process, they're manufacturing discontentment. We live in a world that's amazingly good at manufacturing discontentment. As a matter of fact, our entire economic system in our country is based upon manufacturing discontentment. It used to be that we provided goods. Our economic system originally was based on the idea that there were needs and you would provide goods in order to be able to meet those needs. But as we became wealthier and wealthier, all of a sudden the needs became fewer and fewer. But we needed to continue to drive our economic system. We needed to be able to continue to generate revenue. We needed to continue to get wealthier and wealthier. And so rather than, and I love the way that he says it, in his book Consumed. And if you guys ever get a chance to read the book Consumed, it's really, really good, where he's talking through how this happened inside of our culture. But I love the way he says it, where all of a sudden as a culture, we stopped manufacturing goods and we started to manufacture needs. We stopped manufacturing goods and we started to manufacture needs. And so now, rather than spending billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars in manufacturing goods, we spend billions and billions and billions of dollars to manufacture needs. And so we create this thing called marketing. And what is marketing about? Marketing in a large scale, not all the time, but in a large scale, is about manufacturing needs. Do you need a phone that will open your door? No. None of us. 3 years ago, we didn't even know that that was a possibility. But I'll bet you in a year, if your phone doesn't open your door, you are going to be discontent with that phone. All my friends' phones open their door. And we have an unbelievable ability, and we've actually created a machine to manufacture needs. They're not really needs, they're wants. But we manufacture these wants, and then we turn and turn and turn and turn that over until it begins to feel like it's a need. And all of it is based on manufacturing discontentment. The truth is, your phone's fine. We're having a fun time with this in my household right now because my wife has a tendency to misplace phones. It's a hobby of hers. And so one of the things that we decided is that if a certain number of phones were misplaced in a year, then she would have to go back to a flip phone. It has been an interesting experience. It really has been. Because you don't understand how much you group text. And then when you go back to a flip phone, but it's amazing. She actually had a friend offer her a free phone. It's like an iPhone 4. It's so old. I don't even know how to plug it in. But she had a friend offer, and she is so grateful for it. So grateful for it. And so content with that phone. The truth is, there's no reason that we wouldn't be content with our phone. There's no reason why we wouldn't be content with our home, with our white refrigerator, except for the fact that we have an unbelievable ability to manufacture discontentment. And the world around us does this for us, but we also do this ourselves. Some of us are better at it than others. Some of us participate in it more than others. This is a huge part of my life. I struggle with this more than I could ever possibly tell you. It's because I'm hyper-competitive. That's a real word. It's not just that I'm competitive. I'm hyper-competitive. I've seen people about my competition problems. Okay? And as I walk through life, I have this unbelievable ability, because of my competitive nature, to manufacture discontentment. This summer, my family and I went on vacation, and it was amazing how God provided for us. Not only how he provided for us to be able to go on vacation, but then how he provided for us when we got there in the room that we were able to have and everything that we were able to enjoy. And I walked into the room that they put us in, and it wasn't the room that we had originally booked, and I was amazed. It was going to be perfect for us. Our kids were going to be able to sleep in one room. We were going to be able to, you know, if you have kids, you know that hotels are interesting, because if you go to a hotel, your kids have to go to bed at a certain time, which means you have to go to bed at a certain time, unless you want to sit in the hallway, right? So it's awkward, but it all worked out, and I walked in. I loved our room. It was amazing, until a day later, I walked past our neighbor's room, and the door was open. I was like, I wonder if I could go to the front desk. I wonder if there's any way. And obviously, it's insane. But in my head, I actually allowed that to stick in my head for over a day. I have a crazy ability to do this. Now you're all thinking I'm strange. That's okay. But because I know you do this to an extent as well. Maybe not as much as I do it. Maybe not to the extent that I do it. But I know all of us struggle with this. We have an unbelievable, almost unparalleled ability to be able to manufacture discontentment. And in the process, we drain the life out of what we've been given. And I used to think, and when I first started having this conversation with God, when he started to really work on me about this, because this is a conversation that he's been having with me for over a year, when he first started to work with me about this, I thought this conversation was about being grateful for what I had. I thought it was a conversation about how I interacted with what I had been given. But as I've been engaging him in this conversation for longer, I've realized that it's much, much bigger than that. I've realized that the problem is not just, and I know as even as we've begun to talk about this, for you, as you're interacting with it, and for me, when I first started interacting with it, we think, okay, the problem is that how I feel about where I am or my situation. The problem is how I feel about what I've been given. The problem is but it goes much, much deeper than that. It's much, much bigger than that. And as he engages us in this conversation, as he engaged me in this conversation, he was working to call me to a deeper understanding of the role that contentment and discontentment plays in our lives. Because it's about so much more than how we feel about what we have. It's actually at the very core. It's actually at the very core of our ability to follow Christ. So this isn't something that just exists in our culture. This isn't something that just started a couple years ago. This is something that has been a part of our story from the very beginning. Let me ask you something. Let me ask you something. What was it that contributed to the fall, that contributed to the moment when sin enters into the picture? What was it that led Adam and Eve to take that fruit from the tree? It was manufactured discontentment. They have the whole world to enjoy. They have this everything. All of their needs have been met. They're living literally in paradise. They have everything to be grateful for, everything to celebrate, everything to enjoy. It's all theirs. It's their giant playground. It's all available to them. And the serpent comes to Adam and Eve and said, yeah, I know. Look at all this that God's given you. But there's that tree. But there's that one tree. And what does he do? He manufactures discontentment. Were they actually discontent? Did they have anything to be discontent about? No. But he comes to them and says, yeah, I know you got a lot. I know, but there's that one thing. There's that one thing. And he begins to manufacture within them discontentment. And that discontentment gives way to sin. It's actually what leads them to walk away from God. This is a much bigger conversation than just how you feel about what you have. And God has been interacting with me in this and calling me to a greater understanding of it because here's what I would challenge you to do, okay? Here's what I would challenge you to do. I want you to think back about those moments in your life and the decisions that you made that led you in a direction you never wanted to go. Those decisions in your life where you think back and say, man, if I could go back and change that, if I could go back and change that, if I could go back, if I could just have one more chance at that decision, it is amazing to me. I'm not saying every one of them, but it is amazing to me in my life as God has walked me through this. It is amazing to me how many of those decisions were impacted and influenced highly by manufactured discontentment. There are moments in my life where I was dissatisfied with what I had, and this unbelievable discontentment drew me to make decisions that would eventually bring phenomenal destruction into my life. So many of the decisions that we make to walk away from God are the result of discontentment, much of which is manufactured. So we don't believe that we have what we need or what we want. We don't believe that we have enough to be content. And so rather than trusting him, we begin to take shortcuts. Rather than trusting him, we begin to compromise. Rather than trusting him, it's amazing how the two are connected. This isn't just about how we feel about our stuff. This is something at the very core of what it means to follow Christ. And again, this is not new. As a matter of fact, I think that when you look at the nation of Israel, one of the things that God is trying to help us see when he gives us the story of the nation of Israel is how discontentment and specifically manufactured discontentment impacts our ability to follow him. So when you look at the Old Testament, and for those of you who are new to the scriptures and working through it, the story of the nation of Israel is given to us in the first several books of the Old Testament. And as you look through that and you look at the story of Abraham and Moses and how this begins to develop, specifically as you look at the nation of Israel as God is leading them to the promised land, one of the things that you see over and over and over again in the life of the nation of Israel is that there is a problem with contentment. And that problem with contentment continues to lead them to make destructive choices. I'll take you to one. For example, it's found in the book of Numbers. And in the book of Numbers, we're introduced to a situation where the nation of Israel is interacting with God about how he is providing for them. A little bit of the backstory here. When God decides to lead the nation of Israel out of Egypt and take them to the promised land, he says, okay, I want for you as we engage this journey, I'm going to provide for you. And so here's what I'm going to do. You're not going to have to bring food along for the journey. I'm going to provide the food for you as you're on your way. So he decides, and through this amazing miracle, what he does is that every morning when the nation of Israel wakes up, outside there's a substance on the ground that they're to collect, and they call it manna because they don't know what to call it. Manna literally means what is it? They have no idea what it is. And so God says, here's what I want you to do. Every morning when you wake up, you're going to be able to go out, you're going to be able to collect what you need for that day, right? And you're going to have all of the food that you need for this journey, and I'm going to provide it for you every single day. And he does this amazing thing for them. It's amazing, not just from a food perspective. And we usually think about it from a food perspective, but it's amazing for them in about a hundred ways. I used to lead wilderness trips in Canada, and we would go out for weeks at a time into Algonquin Provincial Park, and we would carry with us everything that we needed for the week. Do you know what what consumed most of our bags? Do you know what took the most space? Food. You know what weighed the most? Food. What God does with manna is not just about the food that they're going to eat. It's about the ease of the journey. He says, you're not going to have to carry food with you everywhere you go. You're not going to have to constantly worry about working it, about preparing it. You're not going to have to worry about producing it and how you're going to continue to produce it or keeping up with it. He says, no, I'm going to take care of all of that. Manna is not just amazing. It's not just a miracle from a food perspective. It's amazing in how God is taking care of his people on this journey in all sorts of different ways. But the nation of Israel, rather than being grateful for what they have, they begin to struggle. And then listen to what they say. I'm just going to read you just a snippet of the story. It's in Numbers chapter 11, verse 5. It's in your online program if you want to check that out. All the verses are in there so you can kind of follow along with us. Numbers chapter 11, verse 5. It says this. This is the nation of Israel talking to God about manna. It says, we remember the fish we used to eat for free in Egypt. And we had all the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic we wanted. But now our appetites are gone. All we ever see is this manna. And they begin to, as God is providing for them on this journey, rather than them being able to be content with what they have, all of a sudden they begin to develop this discontentment and manufacture this discontentment. And the crazy thing is, this is so important. When we begin to manufacture discontentment, logic is not connected to it. And we think that it is. So they think that it is. They think, no, this isn't manufactured discontentment. This is real discontentment because we keep having to eat manna over and over and over again. So we need something else. But there's no logic in it at all because look at what they say. Oh, we remember the fish we used to eat for free in Egypt. Why'd you eat it for free? Because you were a slave. Because you owned nothing. Right? We had all the cucumbers, melons, leeks, and onions, and garlic we wanted. Was that true? No, it wasn't true. They're slaves. Everything they had was controlled. Yeah, you got to eat fish right before and after you got beaten. Right? I mean, it's ridiculous. Their mentality is divorced from logic, but they're just manufacturing this. And they know, and they have the ability to do exactly what you and I have the ability to do. It doesn't have anything to do with logic. You're not really thinking through it. It just gets in your head, and then all of a sudden it begins to spin and spin and spin and spin and spin until you say something stupid like this. And the crazy thing about it, as you look at this and you see it over and over again in the nation of Israel, the problem is not just how they feel about what God has provided in manna. The problem is that when they get to this point, it often leads to them making decisions that end up destroying them. And it leads them to make decisions that cost them dearly. It's about so much more than how we feel about our stuff. It's at the core of what it means to follow Christ. And for many of us, our struggle to follow Christ, and we didn't even know it, our struggle to follow Christ is rooted in, driven by our constant state of discontentment. The reality that for many of us, if not most of us, we live constantly in a state of discontentment. And so we hear Jesus use words like joy and peace. And we have no idea what they look like. Why? Because the Spirit isn't producing joy and peace in us. Why? Because it's not available to us, because God didn't give us that gift. No. I think the Scriptures are calling us to realize that what's destroying the joy and the peace in our lives is not that we can't have it, but it's the discontentment that we continue to allow to be a part of our journey. This is the world that we live in. This is the culture that we live in. And our culture in particular has gotten really, really, really good at it. We've made an art of it. Not only are we not fighting against it, we have embraced it, and we have designed systems to continue to create it. This is the world that we live in. But here's what I want for you to grab a hold of as we walk through this series. Listen. As a follower of Jesus Christ, this is not your story. This is not your story. And this is not your reality. I want to take you to a passage. It's a passage that we actually talked about just a couple months ago. It's a passage that many of us have heard over and over again. I've probably heard this passage thousands of times in my life. As a matter of fact, when I start to read it, for some of you, you're going to think to yourself, oh, I already heard this passage. Oh, I know where this is going. Oh, but I just want you to stick with me for a little bit, because I think there's something in it that we have missed, and something in it that speaks unbelievable hope into our story. Listen to this passage. It's found in Philippians chapter 4, beginning of verse 10. It says, "How I praise the Lord that you are concerned about me." And this is Paul talking to the church at Philippi, and they've been asking, "How can we help you?" And he says to them, "You know, I'm excited that you're concerned about me again." He says, "I know that you've always been concerned for me, but you didn't have the chance to help me." He says, "I know that you've always been wanting to help me, but you didn't really have the chance." And then he says something interesting. He says, "Not that I was ever in need, for I've learned how to be content with whatever I have. I know how to live on almost nothing or with everything. I have learned the secret of living in every situation, whether it is with a full stomach or empty, with plenty or little." And again, I know you, for many of you, you've heard this verse before. And so even as I read it, you're thinking to yourself, okay, I get it. I understand. You're telling me that I'm supposed to be content. You're telling me that I need to be content. You're telling me, no. Before you jump to any assumptions, let's just look at the passage. Let's just look at the passage one more time, because there's a word in it. There's a word in it that we should cling to. Let me take you back. We'll jump into verse 11, right? So it's after he's already talked about you're looking to help me. Listen to what he says. He says, "Not that I was ever in need, for I have learned how to be content." This word should stick out to us in ways that should change our whole approach to this entire concept. As I said, I've heard this verse thousands of times probably, and people quote it and people share it, and I've heard it over and over and over again, but it wasn't until God began to really work with me about this idea that I saw something in this passage that I'd never seen before, or something stood out to me that I'd never seen before. You see, Paul is a writer that we hear from a lot in the New Testament. And so as you read through Paul's writings, you get used to the way that he writes and the things that he says. Paul writes the majority of the New Testament as he's writing to the different churches. Paul, when he writes, he uses certain types of words to talk about his journey. So he often talks about how he's striving for things. He said, I'm striving for this. He'll talk about how he wants something. He'll talk about how he's working towards something. He'll talk about how he's struggling with something. Or he'll talk about how he desires something, or he's pursuing something. You hear him use these words all the time. They're words that accurately capture our journey. Because on the journey of following Christ, for a lot of our journey, in a lot of ways, our journey is lived in the not yet. In other words, we're pursuing something that we're not going to actually experience fully until we're with Him. So I want to be able to love well. I want to be able to love without ever letting the people down around me. That's something I can pursue, but because of the fact that I still live with my flesh and my flesh is broken, I'm never going to get there. So Paul, when he's talking about overcoming sin, he says, I'm pursuing it. I'm struggling with it. I'm striving for it. I want it, but it's not yet completed because it's an ongoing journey. When he talks about the mission, he talks about this way. As you read through the letters of Paul, you hear him using words, especially as it pertains to his journey with Christ, that have not yet been completed. So they're ongoing struggles on the journey. But then, and this is why this verse should stick out to us, but then he comes to this and he uses a different word. He uses a different idea. Because He doesn't come to us and say, you know what? I have struggled for contentment. He doesn't come to us and say, I'm learning contentment. He doesn't come to us and say, I'm striving for contentment. He doesn't come to us and say, I want to be content. He doesn't come to us and say, I'm wrestling with contentment. No. He comes to us and doesn't just say it once. He uses it twice. I checked the word in the Greek to make sure it was a right translation. It is the right translation. This is exactly what he's saying. He says, I have learned it. It's done. He says, this is something in my life that's finished. I learned it. I don't know about you, but to me, that is amazingly encouraging. One, because there aren't very many things like that on this journey for us. A lot of the things we live in the not yet. And so for Paul to be able to say, no, I this is a reality. This is the reality that I live in, that I live in contentment. I learned it. That is unbelievably encouraging, because I think God is using this to speak into your life and my life to say, listen, you don't have to live in the reality of the world around you. We talk about this manufactured discontentment and constant longing and inability to be able to be satisfied and content. That is the world in which we live, but that is not our story. And Paul says, it's no longer my story at all. I learned it. And I think that God is speaking into your life and my life. And I think he's saying, listen, you don't have to live like this anymore. And it's not just an ongoing journey for you. You can actually learn how to let the manufactured discontentment go. And to live a life that's content. Let me ask you something. just for a second, what would it look like if you were actually content? What would your life look like if you were actually content? Think about all the worry that's a part of your everyday life because of manufactured discontentment. Think about all of your life that is spent responding to manufactured discontentment. Think about all the money that's spent. What would your life look like if you were actually content? For some of us, even for myself, as I've been walking through this, it's almost hard for me to imagine because it's such a different reality than the one that I've lived in. What would it look like? If we were able to say what Paul has said, I learned that. That is, no, I've learned how to walk away from discontentment. Whether I have a lot or whether I have a little. I don't know about you. I don't know what it will look like. But I do know one thing. I want it. I want it. Because I know it will be better. And not just from the perspective of how I feel about my things, but from a perspective of how I'm able to follow and engage the one who has loved me most. I want it. And I'd be willing to bet that you do too. And so what we want to do for the next few weeks is we want to look at Paul's journey, because as Paul shares with us his story, I think that he shares with us clues. I think that he shares with us the foundation upon which he was able to enter into this reality. And so what we want to do is we want to talk through, okay, how did this work for him and how does it work for us? Because we don't have to live that story anymore. We don't have to live that story anymore. And I think Paul comes to us, he doesn't just say, I learned it, but he comes to us and says, this is what it looks like. I want that, but how do you do it? I mean, how do you do that? How do you make that shift from something that we lived in for so long? How do you do that? The most important thing, the most important step, the foundation of all of it is what we talk about next week. We don't have to live in that reality anymore. Will you pray with me? Father, the words that you inspired Paul to write are overwhelmingly hopeful. That this is not just a constant striving, that this is not just something that we learn that we should do or that we ought to do, but that this is something that in Paul's life had become a reality. Father, we want to experience you and know you in that way. Not so that we'll feel differently about our stuff, but so that we'll feel differently about you. So that rather than continuing to doubt you, rather than continuing to walk away from you or question, that we would be able to follow well, that we would be able to love you well,
And so, Father, we ask that this not just be a conversation of words, but that this would be a conversation in which your Spirit works in our hearts, our lives, to help us root out, the source of that discontentment, and to step into the reality that you say is possible. Father, we love you, and we look forward to engaging this journey with you. In Jesus' name, amen.